of Babelfresh is the gathering of many women in one place. Many of us will come from different backgrounds, different churches, and even different states. And each one of us is on the journey of discovering God in a brand new way.
Whew. Good morning, everyone. This was a nice coffee warm-up, Katie. Good job. I think by now we're all warmed up. Nice. I'm in my stilettos, and I did not tumble down. This is already a victory. When you stay at home and you work from home, you don't get to walk in stilettos very often. So I thought I will be more enough today by wearing stilettos, just like Robin was talking about. So here are my stilettos, and I love them. But if I do tumble down, I do have a plan B. Katie will give me my flats that I came in this morning. So she will hand deliver me my flats. I titled my talk, A One-Step Program to Living Again. And actually, I'm so glad today is finally here. I have been carrying this message in my heart since probably October. This is when the Lord began to talk to me. And so when Michelle asked me to speak here at the conference, I knew exactly what I'm supposed to say, because this message was born in my heart way before, a few months before that. But I also know this is, in fact, a ladies' conference, right? All of us are ladies. There are just a few men helping. And it would be great if I based all my talk on a life of a woman, but I did not. Instead, we will be learning a lot from a life of a man. Not just any man, a naked man. I know, this is ladies' conference, we're talking about naked man. Not just naked man. I know, it's crazy. Not just naked man, a demon-possessed man. I mean, crazy man, right? That's what it was. And not just crazy man, a man who was homeless and living in a cemetery. But I think as we dive into the life of this person, he's actually going to teach us quite a lot. And so if you brought your Bibles, I would love for you to open Luke chapter 8. And we're going to begin at verse 27. And just to give you a little bit of a preview, this story is going to begin right after Jesus, along with his 12 disciples, were on the boat. They were crossing the boat. And remember, a great storm happened on that lake while they were crossing it. Probably a pretty severe storm, because some fishermen were so afraid they're going to die. But what does Jesus do? He's just peacefully sleeping. He's just dozing off. And then they wake him up. Jesus, why are you sleeping? We're about to die. Jesus gets up, rebukes them for having little faith, comes the storm, and now they cross this lake. And this is the next thing happened after they crossed it. So let's read verse 27. As Jesus was climbing out of the boat, a man who was possessed by demons came out to meet him. For a long time, he had been homeless and naked. There he goes, living in the tombs outside of town. As soon as he saw Jesus, he shrieked, fell down in front of him. Then he screamed, "Why are you interfering with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Please, I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had already commanded the evil spirit to come out of him. This spirit had often taken control of this man. Even when he was placed under guard and put in chains and shackles, he simply broke them and rushed out into the wilderness completely under the demon's power. Jesus demanded, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, for he was filled with many demons. And the demons kept begging Jesus not to send them into the bottomless pit. And you know how the story goes. Jesus spots a herd of pigs. He gives permission to those demons to enter into those animals, and the pigs fall off the cliff and drown in that same lake. A crowd soon gathered around Jesus, and they saw the man who had been freed from demons. Now, this is very important, now he was sitting at Jesus' feet, fully clothed and perfectly sane. And they were all afraid. And then those who had seen what happened told the others how the demon-possessed man had been healed. And the people in the region begged Jesus to go away and leave them alone, for a great wave of fear swept over them. So Jesus returned to the boat and left, crossing back to the other side of the lake, back again on that same lake. And the man who had been freed from the demons begged to go with him. But Jesus sent him home saying, "No, go back to your family and tell them everything God has done for you." So he went all through the town proclaiming the great things God has done for him. Listen, this is one of my favorite Bible stories. And here's why. It paints such a beautiful picture between who this man was before he encountered Jesus and who this man became. Such a drastic picture, and I love it. We don't know a lot about him. We don't know how old he was. We don't know his name, really, his real name. We don't know why in the world did he end up having all these demons in him. I mean, one demon is too many. This man had a legion of demons. But a few things Bible does tell us. For example, we know that he was homeless. He was naked. He was demon-possessed, and he lived in a cemetery. And so what I would love for us is to actually explore each one of those little things that we do know about this man in detail and see what is it that we're going to learn. The first one is that this man was homeless. It means that he did not have a place of belonging. He didn't have a home to go to. It means that he did not have any fellowship because he had none. And he had no place of refuge and place of love. You see, all those things are easily found in a family and in a home setting, right? But if you take family away, a home out of your life, it's none of that. But I think if you actually take all of that fluff out, in the heart of it all, I think this man was actually living a life of an orphan. He was actually an orphan. Somewhere along the way, this man had lost his name, a true name. He lost his family, his home, and his future. I guarantee you this man was not named Legion when he was born. I mean, who names a child? "Hey, darling, I'm going to name you Legion." No. But somewhere along the way, this man actually lost his true name and he's lost his true identity. And you know what, ladies? A similar journey can actually happen to you and me. A very similar journey can happen to you and me. And here's what I mean. When I invited Jesus into my heart, automatically, I became a daughter of the King. The moment you invited Jesus into your heart, automatically you became a daughter of the King. Do you realize what that means? Just let that sink in. You're not a daughter of something or someone. You are the daughter of the King of Kings. Eternal Father is your Father. Think about it. You are today. This is your first identity. You're the daughter of a king. But the same moment that you became a daughter, the enemy waged a war against your daughter identity. Oh, he's so relentless going after that identity. In fact, creating spiritual orphans, creating orphaned daughters, is one of the biggest agendas on his heart, if he has a heart. And here's why. A daughter will always know that she's wanted. If you're a daughter, you will always know you're loved no matter what. You will always know that you're chosen. You're full of faith and confidence, and that you will always know, no matter what, you will always have full access to your Father. And because of that, you will always have a glorious inheritance and a beautiful future. This is what it means to be a daughter. It's huge. It's not a little thing. Oh, I'm a daughter of the King. No, 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 no. If this is what you think right now, I want this truth to sink in. You are the daughter of a King. It's huge. It's a big deal. It's what he accomplished on the cross. But if you're an orphaned daughter, this is what you would feel. You would feel rejected. You would always doubt that you will ever be taken in and loved, even though this is the deepest desire of your heart. An orphan will always feel abandoned, will have little faith, but lots of fear and anxiety. An orphan will always feel unworthy of God and his love. And an orphan daughter will always live as if it's still up to her to figure everything out, as if there is no daddy who will open the door for her. It's a big deal. A daughter will always have an ongoing relationship with her father, no matter what the circumstances are. Because you know, you will always have access to your daddy, right? I'm speaking from personal experience, actually. This is not just a theory to me. It cost me something to actually write all this thing. In October, I thought it would be a great idea to ask myself a question. I ask a lot of questions. And I thought, it would be great. My friend actually inspired me, that friend who is taking pictures. She had inspired me to ask that question. And the question was this: what is the biggest lie that I believe? I never asked myself that question. And you know what? I couldn't put my finger on one. So then I went back to the Lord and I said, well, Lord, you know everything about me. What is the biggest lie that I believe? Can you show it to me? And he did. You know what he said? He said, Jenny, your biggest lie, your big fat lie, is that you are not wanted. I am not wanted. That was my biggest lie up until October. And I said, Lord, really? Do I really believe this lie? He said, yeah. Look into every area of your life and you will see the DNA of this lie spread throughout. And that's exactly what I did. I looked in all kinds of areas of my life. Parenting, for example. I saw the DNA of this lie even there. My friendships, relationships, oh yeah, it was definitely present there. My marriage, yes. But then I looked especially closely into the area where it's just me and the Lord and no one else present, like no one. And I saw this lie: I am not wanted by my heavenly daddy. This is really what I believed. So then I went back to the Lord and I said, my goodness, Lord, that is just the craziest lie. Why would I believe that? How did it happen? Where did it come from? And this is what he said to me. He said, Jenny, you believe this lie because you live a life of an orphan. You are an orphan. This is what you believe about yourself. I was like, really? I'm an orphan? I'm not an orphan. And you know what? I did not like this answer at all. And I began to argue with him. For several days, I actually argued with him. I would go to bed, wake up, think of another argument that I can present and say, listen, I worked in an orphanage for 2 years. I know who orphans are. I've seen the worst orphans. I've seen the best orphans. I'm not neither. I've seen orphans being adopted. I've seen orphans being left behind. And to be an orphan, you actually have to live in an orphanage. I've never lived there. Just worked there. And I kept arguing with him. But then, interestingly enough, this is what he said. He said, you know, Jenny, you don't have to live in the orphanage to become one. It kind of just happens. So then I went back to him and I said, well, how did it happen to me? Because I definitely didn't think I was an orphan. And this is what he said to me. There are three factors. He highlighted three factors that played a huge role in me developing this orphan spirit that I carried for quite a few years. I did grow up without a dad. My father passed away when I was 4.5 years old. And for many years, you know what I tried to do? I tried to convince myself it was not a big deal. It's okay. I still have a wonderful mom. She loves me. She took good care of me. She provided. We lived well. But you know what? She could actually never be my dad. She was just an awesome mom, and I love her. But she was never my daddy, and she could never be one. Now I have 3 children, and I love watching them have special relationship with my husband, their daddy. It's nothing like it. I could never become a dad, ever, to them. I can only be a mom. So I grew up without having a father connection, without certain amount of safety and security the father brings. And it affected me, how I related to my father. And maybe you also grew up with that idea. Maybe your story wasn't so profound, but apparently, if the Lord showed it to me as number one, it was pretty profound. It affected me. The second factor that played a huge role in me becoming an orphan is that I am a person of three countries, three very, very different cultures, three continents and two languages. That's where my accent is coming from. In fact, I don't know where it's coming from. I have three countries in me. I don't know which country I belong. I grew up in a country called Tajikistan. You will find it next to China and next to Afghanistan. Very far away, but beautiful, beautiful country. Beautiful, colorful. The colors everywhere were just beautiful. The Tajik people, they love color. It's a warm climate. Tajikistan houses second largest mountains in the world. The Himalayan mountains eventually will become Pamir mountains. Beautiful country. I loved it. And you know what? I planned to live there for the rest of my life. If you think your childhood was good, mine was better. It was. It was just full of safety. The Tajik people were so lovely and hospitable. I just never thought I'll ever, ever leave. That's me in my childhood. There's another slide. These are Tajik women. Love them. Beautiful. Beautiful culture. But then we kids, we begin to hear words like Taliban and war and instability. We didn't know what all those words meant. But one day, I came home. I was at my friend's house. Then I came home. My mom said, you know, some of our friends are coming today to help us pack because tomorrow a container is going to come and pick our things and we're shipping them to Russia because in 1 month we're going to be moving to Russia. And now, at this point, I was in my early teens. Now, I visited Russia. I had relatives. My cousins all lived in Russia. But I've never lived. There was a foreign country to me. But in 1 month, I was uprooted from my place, the place I loved and cherished, and planted into a brand new culture and country and among the brand new people. I had to learn how to live in Russia. When we moved to Russia, people said, you say things differently than Russian people would. You have an accent. You know, that whole accent thing just follows me my whole life. It's just, maybe in heaven I will not have an accent. I bet I will have a perfect pronunciation of every word. But Russia became my new home. And I had to learn how to live there and how to live with people. But this is the place where I began to hear that big fat lie for the very first time. I am not wanted. Because I was a newbie. New person. Early teen. Everybody already had their friends, and I ended up having no friends. It was a really hard transition for the next 2 years. It was really hard. And that lie began to settle in. You are not wanted. You don't matter. Nobody cares for you. And it began to take quite deep root. Well, then, but not all things were dark and grim in Russia. No, no, no. The town we moved, it's called Vyborg. Some of the people from Northlands had actually visited. It's a 700-plus-year-old town with a beautiful castle in the middle. And that's the place where I began to hear the name Jesus for the very first time. You see, Tajikistan is a Muslim country. There was no Jesus. So at 13, I began to hear this name, Jesus, and I was like, who is Jesus? And I was embarrassed to ask because everybody seemed to know that name, and I was like, who is Jesus? Kto Jesus? I just thought, this is what I thought. I thought Jesus was a Greek god. But I encountered Jesus. Somebody invited me to a meeting, and at that meeting, they were talking about Jesus. And I encountered his love. And he became my friend in the midst of times when there were no friends. And the trajectory of my life changed forever because of Jesus. In Russia, I also met my husband, who's actually American. But it so happened that his family felt that they were called to go to Russia to minister to people in Russia, in that same town. And I met Joe, and we fell in love. We got married, but then the Lord began to tell us that it's time for us to go back to America. And America became my third country, third continent, third culture, third group of people to learn, to understand how the American mentality works, And so again, I was uprooted to be planted yet in a new place. And the reason why I'm telling you that is that it affects. I'm happy. I think it's amazing that I have this international background. But in a way, I paid a price because my roots could never really go down. And it helped me to really develop that orphan spirit in me. And in America, again, I began to hear this big fat lie, you're not wanted. Nobody really cares where you came from. Nobody cares that you speak two languages or that you've been all over the world. It doesn't matter. Your story is not interesting. Not that people really told me those things. I've never heard people say that, but it's the lie of the enemy. And when the enemy wants to sell you a lie, guess what? Oh, he's going to provide plenty of evidence. Plenty. He's just that good, unfortunately. And so the third factor that I quickly want to mention is I was the first generation Christian. And here's the thing. When I became one, what people around me should have told me is that I became a daughter of the king. But no, that's not what I was told. You know what I was told? Now you're a servant of your amazing God. And so for many, many years, what I believed about myself is that I was his servant. That it's up to me to now find favor with God. That it's up to me now to please him, to grow a ministry. That it really did depend how much Bible I read. If I read a lot, he loved me a lot. If I read little, I was loved little. Nobody told me. I didn't know that first and foremost thing, I was his daughter in whom he delights. So I've simply just learned how to be a great servant. And many years later, now I'm learning how to be a great daughter. You see, ladies, we strive to please him by perfecting ourselves. But is it possible? How is it working out for you? Are you perfect yet? I'm not. We're a lot of times thinking if I'll do 5-10 things every day, he's going to be more pleased with me. But guess what? He's already so pleased with every single one of you. You don't have to be perfect. You know why? It's actually set so much freedom in knowing I don't have to be perfect. If you carry Jesus, Jesus is perfect. And that is enough. Let's go back to the naked man. So the first thing we covered is that he was homeless or an orphan. The second thing we know about him is that he was naked. I think today's nakedness actually speaks to shame. Do you hear things like, you're not good enough, you're not qualified, you are not the right size, you have too many flaws, who do you think you are to speak at the conference, you have an accent, this is what I hear. Oh, you don't measure up. You're inadequate. Do you hear those things sometimes? Do you know what it sounds? Do you know what it is? It's the voice of a shame. This is how shame sounds like. And the enemy loves to use shame. It's actually quite an easy weapon to use on us. Remember how people tried helping this man by putting him in chains and shackles? But it never helped, did it? That's what shame does to you and me. Shame puts chains and shackles on your identity, on your destiny, on your dreams, on your future, and on your life. In fact, shame is the opposite of flourishing. I mean, this whole conference is on flourishing. Shame is the opposite of that. Brené Brown has this quote, and I love it. It says, shame is the swampland of the soul. And I completely agree. Not a lot of things can thrive in swamp. Maybe frogs, toads, I don't know. But if an oak tree finds itself in the middle of the swamp, guess what's going to happen to that oak tree? It's going to go through a slow process of disintegration. And at the end, this oak tree will never produce another leaf, acorn, or anything. It's going to rot from inside out. This is what shame does to us. In fact, if you look at the dictionaries, what disintegration means, it simply means the process of coming to pieces. This is what shame does to you and me. Shame diffuses our hope and isolates us from our dreams. But I have a good news. There's always a good news. There is an antidote to shame. And it is sharing. Going back to my story, my revelation that I have believed this lie that I'm not wanted and that in the heart of it all, I was living as an orphan. Do you know what I wanted to do when I realized that? I wanted it to hide. I did not want it to share with 200 plus women here today because I felt shame. I really felt shame. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm an elder. If people could just know that their elder is believing this big fat lie and that I live a life as an orphan, I don't know if I can ever share that. I mean, this is what went through my mind. But then I shared it with Joe, my husband. And at the end of it, I realized, hey, that's surprising. I felt empowered at the very end of it. It's like, what? I didn't think that would be the case. Then I shared it with my friend. My friend and I take long walks sometimes, and we pray on those walks, and I shared it with her, kind of everything. That walk was very long. But at the end of the walk, I realized, oh my goodness, I felt the empowerment and emboldened again by it. And I started to think about it. It's like, wow, I should talk more about it because, hey, sooner or later, this whole shame thing is going to lose its grip. And so then I met with a few other friends for coffee and for breakfast, and I shared this whole story, and they were like, wow. And I thought, wow, I feel so empowered by my own story. And I realized this is what you do with shame. The end to kill it is you begin to talk about it. So ladies, I really want to encourage you that if you're struggling with shame, I know some of us struggle with shame more than others. But if you are, if shame is chasing you, first, I really want to just encourage you, recognize it, look in its eyes and say, I know your voice, I know who you are, and then find someone who is safe, who you can trust, and share your story. At the end of it, you will actually be empowered. The third thing, going back to the naked man again, he wasn't just naked, he was actually demon-possessed. This man was living a habitual life of saying a yes to the enemy over and over and over again. Like I said earlier, having one demon in you is too many. But this man, I mean, his name was Legion. If I was a Roman general, and you came to me and you said, how many people do you have in your army? I would say, I have a legion of men. Do you know what that meant? 6,000 men. It's not a small number. This was the name of the man that we meet in the cemetery. I don't know if he had 6,000 demons in him, but I know it was enough to fill the herd of pigs, right? Hundreds? I don't know. This man was living a life of saying yes to the enemy again and again and again. Same can happen to you and me. When you choose to believe a lie, when you really believe it, somebody mentioned, I think Robin or maybe Lindsay, you're actually saying yes to the enemy. You're giving him the power and authority to occupy your life. So when I said yes to that big fat lie, I'm not wanted, oh my goodness, I've been robbed of so much inheritance. But that's okay. The Lord is always restoring. He's in the restoring business. Sometimes we say things like, well, you know what? It's just the way that it's going to be. It's just the way it's going to be. It's been like that in my family for generations. I'm no different. It's just the way that it's going to continue. Do you know what that is? You're given it. When you believe that, you're given permission for the enemy to occupy the territory of your life that you're talking about. This is your settle yes to the enemy. And we cannot give yeses to him. He doesn't deserve it. The only yes we should give is to Jesus, is to God. And like I said a little earlier, if the enemy is in the business of selling you a lie, he will provide plenty of evidence. A couple of years ago, Joe and I were invited to the wedding, and it was a beautiful wedding. We really enjoyed the people, beautiful ceremony, but their reception was maybe a little bit not very well organized. Maybe it was not as Pinterest like your wedding, right? Well, when it was time to sit down and eat, guess what happened? There were no spot for Joe and I to sit at. I mean, can you imagine, at the wedding? And guess, I know you're so quiet, you're feeling so sorry for me. Listen, it was so sad. It was really sad. And guess what I heard? The very first thing was that was in my heart and in my ear. I told you so, you're not wanted, not even at the wedding. I mean, this is how the enemy works. If he's in the business of selling you a big fat lie, oh, there's going to be plenty of evidence. And I remember leaving that wedding, crying in the car, thinking, oh my goodness, I will never go to another wedding because I'm never wanted, never, ever, 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 ever. That's what my kids say, ever, never, ever. And here's the thing with the lies. If they settle in our hearts, they will rob us of our inheritance. That's what they do. They will rob us of our inheritance. All right, we kind of talked about the ugly things. Now let's look at the most beautiful thing in this whole story. This man, he was carrying a legion of demons. No matter how many yeses he gave to the enemy, no matter how many demons he was carrying inside of him, these demons could not stop him from coming to Jesus. They could not stop him from coming to Jesus. Going back to that verse, the very beginning, as soon as he saw Jesus, as Jesus was climbing out of the boat, the man who was possessed by demons came out to meet him. How could he? He was so powerful. Those demons inside of him were powerful. He was so powerful, he was able to break chains and shackles off. That's how powerful. It's not a normal, it's a supernatural power, demonic power. But here's my question. How is it possible that this man came out to meet Jesus? Wouldn't those demons know that if he were to encounter Jesus, he will be set free? Wouldn't they throw him on the ground? Wouldn't they put chains on him and keep him away from Jesus? No, they couldn't. Because the enemy has no power, has no authority to stop you from coming to Jesus. It has no power and no authority. No matter how many yeses you gave to the enemy, if today you want to come and meet Jesus face to face, the enemy has no power to stop you. Has none. Zero. And this is a one-step program to living again that I titled. You know, in America, there are a lot of programs. There's a 12-step program if you're struggling with addiction. There's 30 days to healthy living to clean your gut and restore your body. There's 14 days to losing 14 pounds. Well, the Bible also has a step program. A one-step program to Jesus. You see, this man, he didn't know anything about Jesus probably. He didn't know the Bible. He didn't pray. The only thing this man did was one step to Jesus. He took one step. How is it possible? But guess what? Jesus was enough for him. He was enough for this man. Because this is the conclusion. A minute ago, this man was living in a cemetery. He was living with the dead. I don't think it's a coincidence that we find this man living in the cemetery. You see, There is no breath, no life, and no future. The only thing that cemetery offers us are memories, past, dead bones, tombs that represent the lives of people. And this is where the man lived a minute ago. But now we find him sitting at the feet of Jesus. Wow! But a minute ago he was living with the dead. But now he's sitting with Jesus at his feet. Whew, how did that happen? One step. A minute ago, this man was naked, covered in shame, living away from society. But now, we find him being fully clothed. A minute ago, this man was a crazy, demon-possessed man. And now, I love that the Bible says he was perfectly sane. It doesn't say halfway sane, almost sane. No, no, no. The Bible says, now this man was perfectly sane. Perfectly sane. When we meet Jesus, it's not a partial. It's 100%. It's not partial. It's 100%. A minute ago, this man was in the natural without any future. There was nothing for him. Nothing. He was the outcast of society. But now, this man is actually carrying a message of life. Wow, how is it possible? This is why this story is one of my favorite Bible stories. And that's why I thought we should talk about this naked, demon-possessed man at the ladies' conference, because I think he's going to teach us a lot, right? So my question is this to you. You see, this man did just one thing. He just took one step forward. Your tiniest action is so much better than your greatest intention. And I want to leave you with a couple of questions. If you were to ask Jesus, Father, what is the one step that I can take today? What would it look like? Maybe the Lord is simply asking you to say yes to something. I loved what Michelle shared yesterday. You never know what's on the other side of your yes. What if it's continents? What if it's nations? What if it's ministries that heaven wants to birth through you? But we're afraid, or we're ashamed, or we don't think we're worthy. Or maybe we just think, well, not through me. I'm not really wanted by God, by my Father. What could your one step to living again or to a different future could look like? What would it be? The second question I would like to ask you is this. You see, for me, this whole story started because I asked God a question. Lord, what is my biggest lie? I can't believe I never asked that question before. I've never. Have you asked yourself that question? If not, I would. It's a great question to ask. And maybe there is no big lie, and that's amazing. It really is. But maybe there's a message that will come out of your biggest lie that you believe. And the third one is this. When Michelle asked me to speak at the conference, and she told me that the whole theme of this refresh will be flourish, I actually sat down and I thought, oh, do I know what makes me flourish? And you know what? I kind of spent a good few minutes thinking through that question. It wasn't easy for me just like, oh yeah, this is it. But now I know because I took the time and I asked myself that question. I would love to encourage you to ask yourself a question too. We're going into the ministry time when you will be encouraged to journal. And just talk to the Lord and talk to yourself. Do you know what makes you flourish? Because if you do, then you'll give the right time to all those things. For example, for me, listen, having three kids is busy, right? When I drop them off at school and I can come inside of my house, close all the doors, pour myself some freshly brewed coffee and sink into the couch, that makes me flourish. God makes me flourish. I'm telling you, it makes me flourish. I don't have a lot of mornings like those, but when I do, I hear God. Time with my husband, where we lock our eyes and our hearts together and I can share those deep things, or he can share deep things the Lord has shown him, those times make me flourish. Time with friends. Oh, I need that time weekly where I can meet with my friends and talk and just share things, cry together, laugh together. My friends make me flourish. And I'm deliberate in making sure I give time to my friends every single week. So this is my message to you. What is your biggest lie? What makes you flourish? And what is the one step that the Lord may ask you today to take? What does it look like? Thank you.